we thank you very much for your sweated labour. Now you know what's behind the leather when it comes out here. There's seminarians that do that. Secondly, let me hand you out. It says, I would warmly recommend a doctrinal session on the oath of the modern world because... And then there's a whole page to fill out. Now, if you wouldn't recommend it, obviously you needn't hand it in. You just... It goes into the circular file. But if you would recommend it, it's got underneath name and date, but as you know, on those yellow flyers, the name doesn't usually get published. I mean, we don't usually print the name. So don't be afraid of putting your name, because it will be kept anonymous. But it's just for, you know, so that I know somebody who was and so on and so on. The date on the other end is interesting, so don't get confused, but this won't be confused.
You say this continuing that sponsor?
Sorry?
Program?
Well, I mean, let's say that it's something that's... you tell me. I mean, if you say to me that this... Don't fill it out now. But if you say to me that this is something eminently worth doing and that you know, it's excellent to have it as well as the spiritual exercises, well then, you know, I'll be that much inclined.
Can you advance it? That's what he has now. Then next year we are a little bit more advanced or so.
CCNN articles, the summary of the first of 3, 4, 5, de Lubac, Balthazar, and I hope you got made a connection between that and what was in Bashendi. And then tonight, then at supper, if you like, you'll be reading the letter you've just been filling the envelopes with, and that's articles 6, 7, 8. That's Cardinal Rats. That's Pope Paul VI, Cardinal Ratzinger, and Pope John Paul II. And they're all children of the new theology, and they're all followers of the new theology. They're neo-modernists. And it's valuable to know, because then you can see how far they are from the Catholic faith. And then when you see how far they are from the Catholic faith, there's no longer any question of sort of wanting to, you know, go halfway to meet them. There can't be any question of going halfway to meet them. They're wrong. You know, I mean, it's astonishing that the officials in charge of Rome are wrong, but when you see an analysis like in CCNNO, you know, there's just no denying. The quotations are there. I gave you the one of Cardinal Ratzinger, that Jesus is the perfect man, and for that very reason he's God. And it's simply incredible. Absolutely incredible. Well, let's take a look at, give you a chance to look at another great error of the modern church, the key error over which Archbishop Lefebvre parted company with the modern church, and that's religious liberty. You may have seen this fly, but again, while you've seen it, you may not have thought about it or had it explained. So this is another of these summaries. This time it's a summary of Michael Davidson's book, which is available to you there. But again, I think the summary may make it rather easier to get hold of the book. And then if I further explain the summary, it should make it easier still.
It's going to be translated in German, as opposed to...
Is it?
No, I don't know.
I don't know.
I have it in English. I just
thought it's possible. Right, the meltdown of Catholicism, religious liberty. Turn to the back of the flyer. It says, why meltdown? The principle of religious liberty. Again, we could have, in your summary of the encyclicals, you've got a summary of Leo XIII on liberty, on true liberty. Libertas Praestantissimum, it's page 4. It's a grand piece. It's a grand piece, but it does need a bit of explaining. It does need a bit of explaining. A key thing to grasp on the whole question of liberty, it's a very, very confused question.
But a little plan will go quite away. Because then you can see better what they're confusing. Liberty. Liberty means absence of constraint. That's a fair definition of liberty. Then you've got three main kinds of liberty. We've got what we'll call, it's a different name there, I think, what's called physical liberty. And that's absence of physical constraint, obviously. That's say, I'm not in a straitjacket. Somebody isn't pinning my arms down. I'm physically free when I can move my body how I like. That's physical freedom. The lack of imprisonment, if you like. That's simply the lack of imprisonment. Okay. The absence of physical constraint. Then you've got what's often called psychological liberty. Psychological liberty, which gets subdivided into two. Psychological liberty means the absence of, is psychological in the sense of what's in the soul. Physical is is more or less the body. Psychological is the soul. So absence of psychological constraint means free will. Let's say it would be clearer, absence of constraint of the body. Absence of constraint of soul. Then I think it's clearest of all. Absence of constraint of soul. Comma equals free will. Free will. That is a faculty. It's not a right, it's a faculty. It's an important thing to get clear. Right, now, physical, psychological, absence of constraint of soul, free will. To choose between good and good is moral liberty. Moral liberty. I'll leave out the liberty. That's just understood. Liberty, which is psychological liberty, physical liberty, or moral liberty. Moral liberty, freedom to choose between good and good. For instance, should I move with my family to New Mexico? There's nothing to stop you. There's nothing to stop you staying where you are. There's nothing to stop you going to New Mexico, as long as there's no temptation involved at any particular time. That's moral liberty. We'll call it moral liberty, I thought. Moral liberty. And then the other is license. Or licentiousness. License is the name given for the freedom to choose. Freedom to choose evil. Right. Now, free will includes both those things. Right. Free will is a faculty. Psychological liberty is a faculty. It's the liberty of my will, which can choose either good, that's moral liberty, or which is license is can choose evil. If I exercise my liberty between one good thing and another, that's moral liberty. I have moral liberty to choose anything that's good, anything that's morally good. But if I use my faculty in order to choose something that's morally evil, that's not liberty, that's license. That is psychological liberty. If I choose to commit a sin, I'm using my psychological liberty. But I haven't got moral liberty to commit a sin. So if I want to murder my mother,
or if I want to murder a modernist,
well, no, let's not confuse that. Stay with murdering my mother. If I want to murder my mother, here she is, she's an old woman, and I have a dagger in my hand. I have physical liberty because nothing has stopped me putting the dagger in. I have psychological liberty because I can use my free will to commit that sin. But I do not have moral liberty because it's a sin, and I don't have a right to do it. I don't have the right to commit any sin. I'm not morally free to commit any sin. So I have to murder my mother, I have physical liberty, I have psychological liberty, I do not have moral liberty. If the bird wants to fly away from the nest, can anybody tell me which liberties it has or hasn't? If a bird wants to fly out of the nest.
Forever or just for?
Oh. Right here and now, just here and now. It has physical liberty unless you tie a thread to its foot. It has physical liberty. Does it have psychological liberty? No, animals do not have psychological liberty. What is the animal is not free not to do what it goes and does. Why? Because everything it does purely by instinct, which is not the same as free will. No animal chooses. Even if a dog comes up to the edge of some cold water with a plate of red meat on the other side and seems to hesitate about whether to go through the cold water to the red meat, it's not choosing. It's simply an interplay of instincts, that's all. An instinctive dislike of cold water and an instinctive like of red meat, and finally one instinct wins, but it's not free will. The animals do not have psychological liberty. Only human beings have psychological liberty. But the animals do have, if they're not imprisoned or tied down or fastened, they do have physical liberty. What's something which I would have moral liberty to do, but not physical liberty to do? Something I would have moral.
Going on the moon.
Sorry?
Going on the moon.
Going to fly to the moon, yes. I don't have the physical liberty to fly to the moon, that's true. But I do have the moral liberty because there's nothing wrong with going to the moon, that's right. Or if I'm in prison and I want to give alms, if I'm locked up in prison, I don't have the physical liberty to give alms, but I certainly have the moral liberty to. Right. So the three liberties are quite different. And notice that the faculty of free will includes moral liberty. Moral liberty is just a part, so it's the right use of the faculty. So moral liberty is a right use, psychological liberty is a faculty. And physical liberty is the lack of imprisonment. Now, interesting question. Let's take an inalienable right. Liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are inalienable rights. Which of these three is an inalienable right? Inalienable right. Which of these three is an inalienable right? Quote unquote.
Physical and psychological.
In other words, all three. The psychological, so to speak, covers moral, includes moral. So if you call these one, two, or one, that's two. That's two. And that is three. So, one, two, and three. Two includes one, because two is the faculty which can be used well or used badly. Right? Now, which of these is an inalienable right?
Three.
I'd say one.
Moral. Well, you don't have, it's not an inalienable right to choose better, though. It's not a right, it's strictly one.
It's interesting. It's right up front. Every man following Locke, John Locke. I think John comes from John Locke, who's an Englishman. Every man has an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I think it's the same. It's John Locke. It's also the Declaration of Independence. But let's take it back to England. It comes from Locke. Everybody takes that for granted, but when you start looking at it, it's a little less than clear.
It's a little less than clear.
Precisely because the liberals blur these. And when they blur these, they cause all kinds of trouble. When you blur these, you cause a... Firstly, is physical liberty inalienable?
No, because you can put somebody in prison for breaking the law. Slavery. Yeah.
It's not inalienable. Then is it an inalienable right?
No.
What might you call physical liberty? It is an alienable right. It's a right if you behave yourself, but if you misbehave yourself, it's no longer a right. Anyone with any common sense, a rampaging murderer has alienated his right to physical liberty. He's due to be put in prison and maybe even executed. He's even alienated his right to life by his behavior, which has rendered him unfit for living in society. Therefore, not even life is an inalienable right. It's alienable, surely. Right? Okay. Is psychological liberty an inalienable right?
Yes.
Is psychological liberty an inalienable right?
No.
Is it a right?
No.
It isn't a right.
No.
It's a faculty. It's a faculty it is inalienable. Psychological liberty is inalienable, but it isn't a right. Physical liberty may be a right, but it's not inalienable. Psychological liberty is inalienable. I mean, as long as I'm a human being, I've got the faculty of free will. Even if they tie me up like Houdini in chains, I'm still free to bless God or curse God inside my soul. I still have freedom. I'm no longer free to pose external acts, but I can still pose internal acts. And I can make them good or I can make them bad. Psychological liberty is inalienable, but it's not a right. It's a faculty. It's not something that society gives you or society takes away. It's right? And what about moral liberty?
Then let's...
Is moral liberty an inalienable right? Have I always got the right to do something that is morally good?
Of course.
Yes.
Of
course. I would say so. And is it inalienable? Is the right to do something good alienable?
No.
It isn't alienable by my faculty and it isn't alienable by society. So that is an inalienable right. Now, question. Did the Declaration of Independence mean that men have an inalienable right to do what is good?
No. You can do whatever you wanted to do.
Which includes?
Murder, whatever.
I'm afraid that's what Jefferson thought. And Locke, too. But they didn't think of it. They didn't think because they didn't analyze. They just used the word liberty. And liberty is a beautiful word, it's a beautiful thing, and let's go gung-ho on liberty. But they didn't think, they didn't stop and think. The drama with Vatican II is that Vatican II didn't stop and think either. Vatican II went the same way. Liberty is always and everywhere and marvelous. There's a very interesting argument of St. Thomas in the Summa. He says, what about the freedom of angels? Because are angels in heaven free to choose evil?
Good point, Your Excellency.
Are angels in heaven free to choose evil?
Yes. After what point? They know their creation.
No, after they have...
after the first rebellion or before?
After the first rebellion.
No, they're not.
They had freedom before the first rebellion. But from the moment of the rebellion, both the devils and the angels, using angels in the sense of good angels, have lost, no longer have the power to choose differently from what they've chosen, right? Okay, who has got the greater liberty? An angel before the rebellion or an angel after the rebellion?
Before.
I'd say after.
Let's put it this way. Who has got the superior liberty? The angel before rebellion or the angel after rebellion?
After, because all they're going to do is go from good to better and so on.
Good angels. They're only using moral liberty.
Good angels, yes. Using angels in the sense opposite to devils.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Then who's got the superior liberty?
The angel
after the rebellion or before the rebellion?
Yeah. After, because they're
we're talking moral liberty, and then you're choosing from good to good. Then.
See, which liberty did Locke and Jefferson most likely consider superior? One or two?
Two.
Anyway, you see. Locke and Jefferson, the liberals, prefer two. The intelligent man prefers one. You think about it. You go into a car merchant, and he's got two cars in the store window. One is a beautiful white Cadillac, which is gleaming and brilliant, and the other is a rotten, beaten, old, rusty up Beetle. But he explains to you. In the Cadillac is a perfectly normal car. The Cadillac has got liberty to have an accident. It's got liberty to go down the road, and it's also got liberty to have an accident. And then the salesman says to you, now look at this beaten up little old Beetle. This has got liberty to go down the road, but it hasn't got liberty to have an accident. Its liberty has been restricted and diminished so that it can't have an accident. Which car do you buy? You buy the car which can't have an accident. You've got any common sense, unless you want to impress the girlfriend, which the youngsters, of course, do. You've got any common sense, you buy the car which has lost its liberty to have an accident. Why? Because what are cars for? To roll down the road. Cars are not for having an accident. Cars are for rolling down the road. If, therefore, a car loses something that will, in its liberty to stop, its liberty to do something other than roll down the road, it hasn't really lost. In fact, it's gained. If the angel has lost his ability to choose evil, he hasn't lost, he's gained. Therefore, anybody who considers that psychological liberty is superior to moral liberty needs their head examined. Because liberty is for nothing other than to do what is good. We're given a faculty to choose between good and evil in order to do what is good. If then my faculty has lost its ability to choose what's evil, I've got a superior faculty. Now, what is the difference of perspective between somebody who puts moral liberty first and somebody who puts psychological liberty first? What's the difference of perspective between somebody who puts psychological liberty first and somebody who puts moral liberty first?
One who thinks before he acts.
If you think, yes, you put moral liberty first. But where is the difference? Why do the liberals glorify psychological liberty? Why have the liberals lost grip of what liberty is for, namely to choose good?
Because they're more interested in this life than
that. Because moral is too restrictive.
Yes, why do they dislike restriction? Why is all restriction bad? Why is even the restriction from having an accident bad? Your liberal will choose the white Cadillac.
Because it limits your freedom.
Yeah, but why is freedom a value in itself?
You have control. You have no freedom.
You have no superior. You have no one telling you what to do. So you have your full... You are the boss. You're number one. Really, that's what it is. No one is telling you what to do. You're number one. So, they like psychological liberty because it makes them feel they're number one. Why would a liberal feel that he was one now? Why does a Catholic not feel that he's number one? Or why does a Catholic not even want to be number one? Because he wants to go to heaven. And he knows darn well, in order to go to heaven, you go to the heaven by obeying the rules. Similarly, when you go into the garden, when you go into the garage, any sane man who goes into the car salesman, he's not looking for a car which is capable of having an accident and rolling down the road. If he could be offered a car which was, could not have an accident, he'd choose it immediately. Because a car is only in order to go down the road. A Catholic, by his faith, knows that a human being is only to go to heaven. In other words, the Catholic understands what a human being is for, and a human being is not a value in himself, whereas the liberal, the human being is a value in himself. In other words, the liberal perspective leaves out God and leaves out heaven. And that's why, if the liberal perspective was right, The superior liberty would be prior to the angelic rebellion and not after it. It would be before the angelic rebellion and not after it. The superior car is the one that can both go down the road and have an accident. For the liberal, a car is inferior, which would be unable to have an accident. And he would say something dumb like, well, I want to always go down the road feeling that I could have an accident. It depends upon me. That's what liberals are like. That, in other words, the liberals who lost grip on God, who lost grip on heaven, and who lost grip on what a human being is for, thinks that liberty is a value in itself. Why is liberty a value in itself? Why is liberty a value in itself? Because it is a feature of human beings which animals haven't got. Right? Liberty is one of those features, like a sense of humor and a sense of music. An ability to make music, an ability to make jokes. Human being, and an ability to build a city. Human beings have got those abilities which animals have. And liberty is one, is the key difference, a key difference between animals and human beings. Now, human beings are very proud of their liberty. And they think that liberty is a value in itself, which it isn't. A liberty is for going to heaven. Human liberty is for going to heaven. Angelic liberty was for going to heaven.
It is just an instrument of transferring soul to heaven.
Liberty is a means, yes. It's something that God gives us. It's an immense privilege that God gives us. But if you think about it, it's actually a dangerous privilege. Why is it a dangerous privilege? Because most men say to church fathers,
none to be
happy. Can be abused.
Most men finish in hell. The majority of men lose their souls. The church fathers say so. Therefore, liberty is actually a dangerous gift. It's a gift. It's not a right. It's a gift. It is given us by God. That's correct. All men are given by God, inalienable rights to life. It's given by God, yes. It's an inalienable... Psychological liberty is an inalienable right. No. It's inalienable, yes, but it isn't a right. It's a faculty. It's a gift. It's not a right. It doesn't give me a claim on anything or anybody. It's just, I've got it. I mean, I've been given it. It's a gift, yes. A right, no.
But you chose that gift.
God chose to give me the gift. You didn't choose free will when you were born.
He gave it to me, but I chose it.
No, you didn't choose it, Joseph. You can't choose whether you've got free will. You choose how you use it. But you can't choose whether you've got free will or not. God chose whether to create you and give you free will.
No, I chose that gift from him.
No, you didn't.
No.
You didn't do any of the kind. Did you choose when you were born, Joseph, to be a boy or a girl?
No.
No, you didn't. Did you choose to be 5 feet tall instead of 7 feet tall?
No.
Did you choose to have brown hair instead of yellow hair? Or whichever color, well, black hair instead of blonde hair? Did you choose the shape of your ears? Did you choose to have free will?
No,
you didn't. It was given to you. It was given to me.
Given? Yes, it's given. But what I'm saying is, yes, he's given me because I choose him.
No. He's giving it to Lenin. God gives the gift of free will to Lenin. God gives me the gift in order that I will make the right use of it. But his giving to me free will does not force me to make the right use of it.
That's what I was
correct?
Saying. What you're saying, that, no? That you choose the right thing. So we go to heaven.
Of course, all of us are given free will in order to make the right use of it. But we don't choose to receive free will. Every human being has free will whether he likes it or not. Right? Unless he's got Down syndrome or something that cramps his faculties. Right? Unless he's got epilepsy or something that stops him using his free will. But if he's a normal human being, he has free will, whether he wants it or not. He's got psychological liberty, whether he wants it or not. He's got physical liberty as long as he's thrown in prison, or as long as he's nailed to a bed by an illness. And he's always got moral liberty to do good. The three are quite different. Larry?
Why is psychological liberty his faculty and moral liberty a right? Is license a right as well?
Well, no. I have a right to choose good. I don't have a right to choose evil.
So
you see, moral liberty is a use. This is a faculty. That's a faculty.
And of that faculty, moral liberty is the right use, and license is the wrong use. Now there again we see why the liberal, if a Catholic says that moral liberty is better than psychological liberty, and if I could choose between the two, I would choose moral liberty. If anybody offered me moral liberty instead of my psychological liberty, I would jump at it. Why? Because from that moment onwards, I could never sin. Finish sin. I'd jump at it. But why then does a Catholic...
Is that what?
See, a Catholic distinguishes between moral liberty and psychological liberty because he distinguishes between right and wrong. If you don't believe in any difference between right and wrong, there's no difference between moral liberty license and psychological liberty. It's all the same thing, right? So we, and again, your liberals do not believe that there is anyone telling them what is right and telling them what is wrong. Your John Locke says, there's no right and wrong. I can do as I like. And for them, there's no difference. It's all the same.
A faculty. What is a faculty?
A faculty is a...
is it
Seelenvermögen? Will, intelligence, these are faculties. The faculty of seeing, the faculty of hearing, the faculty of memory, these are all faculties. Right? A power of the soul to do something. Equipment, if you like, yes, kind of the soul at birth is kitted out with certain faculties, the human soul. And all these faculties, free will is like a faculty. It's the will. The will of somebody who has reason is an intellectual will is automatically free. Interesting to go into that, but in any case, the Catholic sees a difference between moral liberty and psychological liberty because the Catholic distinguishes between right and wrong, and the Catholic knows that a human being is only here in order to do right, and he's not here in order to do wrong. So you've got two very different perspectives on liberty. The liberal uses the word and it just makes him feel good. The Catholic uses the word and starts using his mind. Well, this liberty is pretty dangerous because most men use their liberty and finish up in hell. In that case, was it really such a great gift? Yes.
So, does that fall from then? We got license from original sin then. Is that correct? Say it that way? Without original sin, we would have only had number one.
That's correct.
So, in other words...
I'm sorry, that's not true. Because Adam and Eve did not have original sin. And yet they still sinned.
They had both. So
how was it possible?
Original sin... Adam and Eve had psychological liberty. Right? Right?
Okay.
And they used it in order to eat the apple.
So they
practiced license. Right?
Okay, but with the case of the Blessed Virgin Mary, she did not have license, though. Is that
right? She could... That's true, but she had freedom. Yes, she and our Lord had moral liberty. That's the liberty of Jesus and Mary is a difficult one.
Okay.
But they were impeccable. They could not sin, but they could not sin. Yes, they had moral liberty without having without license. Yeah.
What is it with the Blessed Virgin that she chose? That she says. She becomes the mother of...
Yes, that she had moral liberty. She could have chosen not to. And she would not have sinned if she had chosen not to.
Is it possible to get rid of life?
Just a moment. You follow that?
She, right. That moral liberty, choosing between being the mother of...
Yes,
she would say no.
She was perfectly able to say no without sinning.
Well, good to good, right.
Yes, that's between good and good. That's perfectly example of moral liberty. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yes.
Is it possible to get rid of license?
some saints are confirmed in grace. Yes, the apostles, it's thought, were confirmed in grace, and therefore they from that point onwards they would not sin. They would certainly not commit mortal sin. They were confirmed in grace. It is possible by a gift of God to lose license. Yes. At any rate, for mortal sin.
Maybe Saint John the Baptist, he was purified.
He was cleansed of original sin in his mother's womb,
but he still was stuck with license.
Most likely.
Well, yes. Yeah, the effect of the
Yes.
Been remained.
Yes.
Even though we're baptized.
Yes. I don't know what I think they would say John the Baptist still had psychological liberty, yes. In that sense.
What about St. Joseph? Because he chose not to be a father.
He could have walked away from the Mother of God, and he wouldn't have sinned if he had done so, because he was acting according to his conscience. And then the angel enlightened him as to what happened, and then of course he chose to stay.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have sinned if he'd walked away.
Again, he wouldn't have sinned.
He would not have sinned if he'd walked away.
Right?
If I wasn't Lord and Virgin Mary could not sin,
yes.
Why did the devil lose his mind and try to tempt him?
Because the devil didn't know that our Lord could not sin.
He wasn't convinced of our Lord.
He wasn't convinced that he was God. The devil didn't know who he was. The devil suspected this and that, but if the devil had known that he was a God, he wouldn't have caused him to be crucified. Because the devil lost his kingdom when he caused our Lord to be crucified. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The devil wasn't about to lose his own kingdom if he had anything to do with it. So the devil did not know. There's a very interesting passage, a very interesting section in a book about the Messiah by a Jewish French priest of the 19th century, Chanoine Lehmann, I think it is. A very interesting passage about what the devil, and he's quoting the Church Fathers. The Church Fathers analyze that question. They say the devil was probing, with the temptation he was probing. He saw, he could observe Jesus' virtue. And he said, who is this man? What is he here to do? He's greater than all the prophets. What is he? Is he God? Is he not? Is he the Messiah? Is he not? The devil didn't know.
So the devil doesn't know future in all details?
Of course he doesn't. Of course he does.
He's
only a creature. Only God knows the future in all details.
So, devil, you mean, knows only future in the same sense like human beings?
But superior. He knows the future in its causes, but better than we do. But he doesn't know the future in itself like God does. God sees the future like the back of his hand, right?
Uh-huh.
But human beings and angels only see the future in its causes. For instance, I know that tomorrow the sun is going to rise. And the angels have a much more accurate knowledge of what will happen tomorrow because of what's happening today. Our weather forecasting is good for about 24 hours and even then. But the angels' weather forecasting, since they have got a very, very, very exact knowledge of all the meteorological conditions, they may well know that, you know, they may have a much more accurate... They could tell the future of the weather much more accurately.
So the devil's vision is more clear, but not... He still doesn't know... 100%.
Of course, he doesn't know it like God knows the future. God sees the future as though it was present. The devil can't do. Therefore, the devil did not know what would be what would result from his causing our Lord to be crucified.
Father, you had told us a few years ago something about a Jesuit theologian that it was not non-servian what the devil was saying to
yes.
God. It was that he saw in the future a man, Jesus
yes.
Christ.
Yes.
Is that true?
It's possible that that was the test to which
yeah.
the devil was submitting. We don't know. That's a particular private revelation.
Yeah.
But it's in any case, whatever was the particular test to which the devil was submitted, in any case, the essence of the wickedness of his answer was known servian. I won't serve. It comes back to known servian. I will not submit to God's plan. God is planning to take flesh and to save human beings by being a man. I refuse that. It's a pious thought that's the test that the devil was submitted to, but it's
still known servian.
The principle of religious liberty means briefly that the state must allow equal rights to all religions. We get into a lot of quite complicated questions here. In appearance, this principle is favorable to religion in general and to all religions in particular, because all religions in particular come under religion in general. And it looks as if you're favoring religion by saying that the state must be equally kind to all religions. But in reality, the principle is most harmful to religion, especially to the Catholic religion. That is why cunning enemies of the Catholic Church love and promote religious liberty, whereas the popes always used to condemn it. Now the popes are approving it in the last few years, and that's one of the most deadly things that's happening in the church today. Why is the principle of religious liberty harmful to religion when it looks favorable to religion? The reason is because man is created by God for God to go to God by the one religion which God instituted and sealed with his own precious blood for that purpose. God matters, the true religion matters, the truth matters. In other words, man is not here on earth in order to enjoy himself or to exercise faculty of choosing. Man is, the faculty of choosing is not an end in itself. The faculty of choosing is in order to choose, for men to choose heaven. Right? For the Catholic, freedom is in order to choose heaven. For the liberal, freedom is a value in itself, independently of what use I make of it. In other words, for Catholic, psychological liberty is a means to an end. For the liberal, psychological liberty is an end in itself. That's the huge difference. Reuben?
Is that to know, to love, and to serve our Lord?
Yes.
To take the three
Yes. Jesus. That's what we're for. That's what it is. Now comes the state with religious liberty. And when the state preaches religious liberty, it says in actions which speak louder than words, that all religions, man-made or God-made, are acceptable. That's what the state, this president or that president, may believe in being a Baptist or in being a Catholic. But if as president and as the state it says all religions shall be free, then in actions, if not in words, you're saying all religions are equally good. Right? That's what you're saying in action. The principle of religious liberty says in action, not in words, that all religions are equally good. Remember, actions speak louder than words. But all religions contradict one another. There's some point on which every single religion contradicts another religion. Otherwise, they'd be the same. They didn't contradict one another, they'd be the same religion. Therefore, if all religions are equal and all religions contradict one another, it follows that contradictions don't matter. If contradictions don't matter, then truth in religion doesn't matter. If truth in religion doesn't matter, then truth doesn't matter and religion doesn't matter. And that's exactly the problem that decent liberals keep running up against. They keep pushing religious liberty and they don't realize that they're cutting the ground from under their own feet. Larry?
Real quickly, couldn't you argue that it's the state not choosing a particular religion is simply because the state is incompetent to make the choice?
The liberals argue that. But it's a false argument. The state only consists of men. And every single man has been given by God the faculty to realize which is the true religion. How could God require of all men to belong to the true religion if they didn't have the ability to discern which it is?
Right, but if the state simply doesn't choose for you...
The state consists of men. And it has a responsibility... It's a bunch of leading men who have a responsibility to the sheep men. To the following men. It's only men. And every single one of those men can see and must see and ought to see which is the true religion. The state has no business being neutral. Pick it up at 7:30. It's a crucial point. Now, religious liberty. Then, understand, it's perfectly true. Something that may easily confuse you is that the truth of that is that historically we had Catholicism, and then with time we came down to liberalism, which with time also has come down to communism. This means that liberalism, which religious liberty is really the key part, religious liberty is the most important liberty. And therefore, in a sense, it's the key to liberalism. If you haven't got religious liberty, what do all the other liberties matter? Religious liberty is the foundation of liberty for liberalism. Now, religious liberty, as it's understood today, that's equality for all religions. That's on its way down. Now, the communists hate liberalism. And the Catholics hate liberalism, but for exactly opposite reasons. The Catholics hate liberalism. The Catholics like liberalism because it isn't yet in communism. Let's say, if liberalism means there's still, for instance, there's still liberty for the Catholic Church, that is, as such, a good thing. And if the communists forbade all liberty for the Catholic Church, you know, that would be a bad thing. So, the Catholics like liberalism if it still leaves liberty for what's right. Whereas the communists hate liberalism because it leaves liberty still for what's right. The communists want to shut down the liberty for what's right. The communists want the liberalism to go completely their ways. Therefore, Catholics and communists hate liberalism and like liberalism for exactly the opposite reasons. Communists like liberalism because it's beginning to dissolve Catholicism. They hate liberalism because it hasn't yet struck down Catholicism completely. The Catholics like liberalism insofar as it still gives liberty for Catholicism. But they hate liberalism insofar as it's putting the skids under Catholicism. And those are exactly opposite. And the Catholic argument against liberalism is that while it may seem to leave liberty still for the Catholic Church, in fact it puts the skids under the Catholic Church. And in fact, in the liberal countries today, the faith may be more attacked than it is in the communist countries. Because the communist countries, when they come to you with a gun, at least you know they hate Catholicism, they stand up to it. Here, everybody pretends to be nice to religion, but since they're being equally nice to all religions, they're in fact despising religion. And Catholicism gets smothered in a fire blanket of niceness. Of niceness which absolutely doesn't take seriously what you're really trying to say. You know, in a liberal society, they're so nice to all religions that it's quite obvious that they have completely not understood the difference between Catholicism and all the other religions. If they understood the difference between Catholicism and all their own, they wouldn't be nice to all religions, but they are nice to all religions. Now, the fact that they're nice to all religions means they are still nice to Catholics, but it's not a real niceness. Because they're not understanding what you're trying to say. They're not getting the point that there is one true God, one Savior, and one true Church. They're refusing to get that point. Oh, I know you Catholics, but look at these nice Protestants, and then look at these nice Mohammedans. They're all nice. You're all nice. We're all nice. That's liberalism. And Catholicism gets smothered. The liberalism looks nice, but in fact it smothers Catholicism. And in a liberal head, it's impossible for Catholicism to sit. It's impossible for Catholicism to float on a liberal foundation. Take a country with in a country with religious liberty, where all the religions are put on an equal footing, Catholicism, Protestantism, Buddhism, Mohammedanism, Judaism, what is your gain? What's the name of that religion? Anybody? What's the name of that?
Environmentalism.
I've had it before. It kind of.
Ecumenism.
Yes. Or Masonry, that was the name I gave it, right? See, if you put all these religions on an equal footing in order to get everybody united, what's your real religion?
Something behind this.
What, yes. What is behind all of this, or underneath all of this? What, on what foundation do all of these float?
Freemasonry
or religious liberty? Your real religion is religious liberty. Because that's the basis on which you're floating all of these on an equal footing. Your real religion is not Catholicism. What you really believe in as the right way to run a society and to organize a society is not Catholicism. What you really believe in is religious liberty, which means that religious liberty, without taking the name of religion, is in fact your religion. Your real religion is what you believe in to organize your country. That's your real religion. The religion that goes on in somebody's house, and your house, and his house, and their house, that's not your real religion. Your real religion, religion in a real sense, is how you think mankind ought to be organized. And that's, in a Catholic country, everything floats on the basis of Catholicism, which is completely different.
I've always had trouble with this religious living thing. Being rational about it, from, say, in a country like this, where Catholics are not majority, how can you have anything else but religious liberty?
Okay. The thing is that there's the practice and there's the principles. See, when the Catholic Church started in Rome, obviously, the Catholics were a tiny minority. And it's absurd to imagine that Peter went round saying, you know, we better jail all the non-Catholics, or anything. Peter did say, you had better all be Catholics or you'll go to hell. That he did say. And the martyrs said it, and that's why they got martyred. And the young virgin, the virgin martyrs said it. They told the emperor, I'd rather you could put me on the rack and throw me to the lion and do what you like. But the demon that you want me to give incense to is a demon, right? And because these little girls did not admit religious liberty, they would not admit that the emperor was worshipping any other than the devil, the little girls told the emperor he was wrong. And because of that, they got martyred. That's how the church was built, right? Then when the church, but the little girls did not say, you know, they said that the emperor should be Catholic, that's for sure. But they didn't pretend that overnight, nor did Peter pretend that overnight the whole state was going to be Catholic, right? So in practice, they didn't pretend that the state, given Rome as it was in 100 and 200 AD, they didn't pretend that Rome overnight was going to be Catholic. They did say that it ought to be Catholic, which is absolutely true, but they didn't pretend that it could overnight be Catholic. Right? So they distinguish between the principles and the practice. In principle, every state all over the world ought to be Catholic. And somebody who's understood his faith will not give way on that principle. It's a clear, sharp, unmistakable principle. In practice, you say, well, you know, I admit, I mean, it's only got a whole bunch of Protestants, it's got a whole bunch of Catholics. It's not practical for the moment to demand this country be Catholic, or that England be Catholic, right? It's because a whole bunch of Englishmen have got Protestantism pretty solidly established in their heads, or liberalism. Nevertheless, England ought to be Catholic, or England is going to perish. And that's absolutely true. The problem is when the English Catholic, and there are plenty of them like this, the problem is when the English Catholic, instead of saying, England ought to be Catholic, but I know it can't yet be. Instead of saying that, he says, well, it's a good thing if England allows freedom for all religions, because that's more tolerant and more nice. It's one thing to give way in practice, or to admit that something is impossible in practice. It's quite another thing to say that it's not even desirable in principle. You follow? So you're distinguishing between principle and practice. And the liberals give way on principle. That's the problem. They do not say this country or England ought to be Catholic. They say, well, it's, you know, England's quite well as it is, and I like Protestants, and let's all live and let's be tolerant. That's not Catholic. It doesn't mean to say that the Catholic is wanting to go out there with a knife and gallows for anybody who is not immediately Catholic. But it does mean that every real Catholic has got a clear idea that England ought, at peril of its survival and sanity, and of the salvation of souls, England ought as soon as possible to be a Catholic state. Not just a state full of Catholics, but a Catholic state is a completely different thing.
So you're saying in principle it has to be Catholic.
Yes.
And in practice?
In practice, you may be in a historical situation where you can't expect it overnight. But it's got to go that way, otherwise many, many souls are going to go to hell. Yeah. There's no such thing as a right of the state to hang back from the true religion. Because the state is made of nothing but men, and all of those men have immortal souls created by God, for God, redeemed by the precious blood, and with a duty to accept the faith or be damned, as our Lord said at the end of the Gospel of Mark. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who refuses to believe will be condemned. Right? And a state composed of these men has got to be Catholic as well. This you can prove with another, prove with another picture. Let's take men. Here are a bunch of individuals. And here's a society. Here's a bunch of individuals. Right. Now, in each of these individuals, you've got a funny sort of line. And what does that mean? That's a bunch of individuals. A society is this. Society organized in such a way that that funny line in all of them links up and makes the society. A society is an order of individuals. It's a bunch of individuals, but in a certain order.
Right.
What you've got there is exactly the same as here. I mean, you've got the same number, I'm assuming you've got the same number of white circles, you've got exactly the same amount of yellow, but here it's organized, right? Now, God created every single individual, and God created every single individual to adore Him, God, with everything that is in the individual, right? There's no part of the individual created by God which has a right not to adore God. Part of every individual is his socialness. The fact that he is built, he's made to form part of a society. That's his socialness. That socialness, therefore, owes adoration to God, adoration and worship to God. A man doesn't owe adoration to worship God with just part of him. He owes adoration to God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, with all thy mind. First commandment. And with all thy socialness. Now, how does all of a man's socialness which is built to take part in the society. How does that worship God? Answer, all of the white has got to worship God as white. That means all the little individuals have got to worship God as individuals. And also the society, as a society, has got to worship God. And in a Catholic state, you have, for instance, in Ecuador, in the 1860s, by that great president, García Moreno. García Moreno was, as president of the state, dressed as president, went to mass, and as president, dressed as president, in his official function, adored, honored, and worshipped God. And he made sure that his cabinet went with him. And the cabinet, as a cabinet, adored God. And everybody said they were able to see it. And then on Good Friday, he would proceed, he would carry the cross. As president, he would be in the streets carrying the cross. In other words, that's the state, as a state, acknowledging and worshipping God. And that's how it should be. That's what God has a right to. And that's what men have no right to refuse to God. There's no reason why the white should adore God and not the yellow. Because the yellow is part of man. Man is not. See, liberalism says that we're just individuals. And so logically, liberalism says only the liberals need worship God. But that's false. Because God created the whole man, and we are not just liberal. We are not just individuals. We are social by nature. For instance, you take four boys who've never met one another, 10 years old, let's see. You put them in a field 3 miles square so that they can just see one another. You leave them there. You put them in the four corners of a field 3 miles square. You know what's happening if you leave them there? Within 15 minutes, they've all met in the middle of the field. Within another 5 minutes, one of them is boss. Within another 5 minutes, they've organized a game. That's
human nature, and it's social. And all of that owes worship to God. And you know, if the boys are pious, then at some point they get down, all four of them, and pray the rosary together. And it's a very important part of Catholic worship that it is social. It's very important that the liturgy is not just private devotion. The liturgy is a social action. It's a bunch of individuals praying together as a group through the priest. Individualism, liberal individualism, is not Catholic, and therefore the state owes a duty to God. The state, every state, as a state. Now, of course, non-Catholics are not going to understand that. They may refuse it. The question is not who or who does or doesn't understand it. The question is whether it's true. The question is whether the whole man owes worship to God. And the question is whether the whole man includes socialness. And the question, therefore, is whether the socialness of men bound together in society, in other words, the society owes worship to God. And it's logical. And therefore, the society does not have a right to step back and say, the state does not have a right to step back and say, I'm incompetent. Who's going to say he's incompetent? The president is competent because he's a human being. The vice president is competent because he's a human being. The king is competent because he's a human being. The secretary of state is competent because he's a human being. Every single one of them is competent to tell which is the true religion. Because they've all got a reason which God gives them to discover the true religion which God also gave. And therefore there is a duty of every state as a state to worship God. And it can't back out.
The other side of the problem, in Catholic state, obviously not everyone would be Catholic.
Correct. The Catholic teaching is that in a Catholic state, and this is exactly where Vatican II went off the rails, in a Catholic state, the Catholic religion has a right to be practiced in public, but no other religion has a right to be practiced in public. If people want to practice a false religion in their home, the wise state will tolerate that, will allow that. But it won't tolerate or allow the practice of a false religion in public.
But how far can we allow people to preach or to follow Paul's religion? For instance, Santeria.
If you've got the ability to shut that down, you should. Santeria is voodoo. It's like voodoo. If you've got the ability to shut that down, you should.
But what the difference? Protestantism is a mistake.
Yes.
Santeria is a mistake.
Yes.
So all mistakes should be
shut down in public. That's the Catholic teaching.
But what you said is that persons are allowed to follow, to practice past religions in their homes.
Yes, you tolerate that.
Does it also mean, are they allowed to practice every past religion privately?
That depends. If it's a false religion which stays in the private domain, If, for instance, to your knowledge, it does not murder children or etc., etc., then the state can tolerate it. If it's not obviously harmful, even in private. If it's obviously harmful, even in private, for instance, there's rape and incest and murder and Satan and all kinds of things going on, then the state can intervene even in private and stop that.
As a duty to protect.
As a duty to protect the individual, yes.
Like the Waco thing.
If the Waco people really were harmful in private,
but they were not. They were not.
If the Waco people really were harmful in private, then the federal government had the right to step in. And that's what the federal government pretended. The federal government claimed there was child abuse going on. Whether there was or not is another question.
There was an interview a few days after Waco, and psychologists answered there was no abuse of children.
See? I'm afraid that's likely to be true. I'm afraid there's plenty of indication that the child abuse was invented, was a lie in order to justify the smashing of this resistance. Because this resistance, which combined conviction and guns, is dangerous for the New World Order. And they don't want it. And so they wanted to send a message to everyone. That's the way it's in. So, look at the back. Then we want to get on Michael Davis. Any state that comes along with religious liberty says, in actions which speak louder than words, that all religions, whether they're man-made or God-made, are equally acceptable. That's repeat. The state may well consist of Protestants who are persuaded that Protestantism is the best religion. But if they allow equality to all religions, then with actions speaking louder than words, they are said, all religions are equally good. Now, all religions contradict one another. In that case, contradiction, the state is saying, contradictions don't matter. In which case, the state is saying the truth in religion doesn't matter. The state is saying truth doesn't matter. And the state is also saying that religion doesn't matter.
How does a system object polygamy?
Sorry, I can't handle everything else. We'll have, we must move on a little. This profound discrediting of the human mind and all its ideas, right? The state is saying, which is the organization of men. I mean, it's a pretty serious affair, the state. It's not God, but it's a serious affair. Men are with a very serious part of themselves. When men get together, the yellow in them is saying, religion doesn't matter. And the yellow, you know, is pretty important. And the yellow is saying religion doesn't matter. And therefore men take the state seriously, and therefore they heed the state. If the state says religion doesn't matter, people will think that religion doesn't matter. And if religious doesn't matter, then religious ideas don't matter. Religious truth doesn't matter, then what truth does matter? And if truth doesn't matter, then what ideas matter? All of it is discredited. This profound discrediting of the human mind about all of its ideas, let alone the discrediting of God, leaves sentiment and feeling king. We saw that the other day. That's why you've got such a triumph of sensationalism, of sensuality, and sentimentality in modern life. All of these aspects, you've got the intelligence, and then you've got the senses. And going with the senses is sensationalism, something that makes me quiver as I open a newspaper, sensuality, chasing after the pleasures of the senses, and sentimentality, feeling. I enjoy my feelings. Yeah? Sentiment and feeling are left king. Hence, religious liberty may defuse religious divisions amongst men, but it can only unite men in a sentimental humanitarian mush, which is neither manly nor godly, sound of music. Hence you get modern man and the triumph of trash. That's a harsh expression. But from religious liberty comes the triumph of trash. Because religious liberty discredits God. Because it makes all religion look absurd. It cheapens all religion. Appearing to look after all religion, in fact, logically it cheapens all religion. If you cheapen all religion, you cheapen God. If you cheapen God, you leave man at the level of himself, which is where you get all of this trash. Man without God turns into trash. And that's why there's so much trash, why the 20th century is full of trash. Because of liberalism. How and why religious liberty always used to be condemned by the Catholic Church, and how with Vatican II it at last conquered many churchmen. You can't say that it's conquered the church, it's conquered many churchmen, is the dramatic story told in Michael Davis' book Summarized Within. Turn inside. The Second Vatican Council on Religious Liberty. You've got an intro. You've got again 25 chapters and then 7 appendices. As you can see down the central spine, central column. You've got an introduction. You've got the truth, which is Catholicism. You've got the error, which is liberalism. You've got where the clash between the two took place. You've then got the fruits of the clash, which are the Declaration of Religious Liberty. And then you've got the aftermath, and then he adds in some appendices. So it's a fairly logical order. Catholic against liberal. On November 11, 1963, at a doctrinal meeting in Rome, during the Second Vatican Council, an American Monsignor and an American Jesuit clashed head-on. The Catholic Monsignor Fenton was defeated. He was the editor of the American Ecclesiastical Review. And Michael Davis's book is dedicated to that man. And that man was American. Not all Americans are for religious liberty. Right? There were some who understood clearly the question, but they were defeated because Catholics, the true Catholics, American, French, English, or whoever, were defeated at Vatican II. Okay? The Catholic Monsignor Fenton was defeated. The liberal Jesuit, Father John Courtney Murray, became a folk hero. He was the great champion of religious liberty, as we'll see. Now then, firstly, the truth, the true doctrine of church and state and the true religion. You've got true and false liberty, you've got the state, the nature of the state is duty to Christ, the state's duty as to heresy. You've got papal quotations from the popes, you've then got the doctrine of the common good. The common good, the good of a society as a whole, is what governs whether you should pursue heresy or tolerate it. You can either pursue it or you can tolerate it. If you have to tolerate it, that's less good, but it may be wiser in certain circumstances to tolerate it than to pursue it. You can't always pursue heresy. But according to Catholic teaching, you always have a right to pursue heresy. Even under certain circumstances, a duty to pursue heresy. But at times you may have a duty to tolerate it, because if you pursued it, it would do more harm than good. Where pursuing it would do more harm than good, you've got a duty to tolerate it. But it's always an evil to be tolerated. It's never, toleration is never in itself a good thing. Toleration is always the second best, according to Catholic doctrine. Let's have a look. The Church teaches, 1, 2, 3, 4, that true liberty is to obey God's law. That's moral liberty. To do as one likes is false liberty. So the difference between moral liberty and license. True liberty is to obey God's law. To do as you like is false liberty. The superior liberty is not the broader liberty, including the possibility of doing evil. The superior liberty is the liberty which, although it's narrower in the sense that it excludes doing evil, nevertheless guarantees the purpose of liberty, which is to go for good. Two, the state is a creature of God. The state is the yellow circle, which is created together with the yellowness in every single individual, who is created by God. Therefore, the state is a creature of God. And so the state must worship God and do what it can to bring men to God. Thirdly, then every state must submit to Jesus Christ the King, because Jesus Christ is God. The Catholic knows that, others don't know. But the Catholic knows it, and therefore Catholic knows that every state ought to submit to Jesus Christ the King. And therefore every state ought to favor and protect Catholicism, because Catholicism is the true religion. It's logical. Fourthly, it follows that any Catholic state has the right to repress heresy in public, but it may tolerate it as being the lesser of two evils. In other words, if people are too corrupt, there's no use in pursuing heresy, because it would simply inflame them and make them revolt and make them angry with the Church. In that case, it's better to leave it alone. That's again common sense. Nevertheless, even if the state has sometimes the duty, it's wiser to leave heresy alone and tolerate it, nevertheless it always has the right to pursue it.
As in papal states, what would be the claim, what would be the range of toleration? Let's say you have Jewish minorities. No, it's more.
Jewish minorities have always been extremely well protected in Catholic states. They've been allowed their liberty in private, and they've been even allowed to build their synagogues. But they're not allowed to proselytize the Catholics.
Why were they protected?
Because the Jews have frequently been protected in Catholic states because they make enemies, and people get angry with them, and the Jews need to be protected against the wrath that they arouse habitually amongst other people. The Catholic Church, far from being a persecutor of Jews, has frequently been a protector of Jews. That's a historical fact.
Do they acknowledge that?
Occasionally they acknowledge it. Sometimes they acknowledge it. For their own purposes, they sometimes acknowledge it. When they're being honest, they acknowledge it. Frequently they deny it. Usually, especially today, they deny it. Again, for their own purposes. Seven. Such is the teaching of one pope in modern times after another. He gives the same habitual list. The measure of whether a Catholic state should repress or tolerate heresy in public is the common good. You can tolerate it in private. I mean, it's perfectly normal to allow people to practice their own religion in private. That is normal because people have free will, and you can't force them to the true religion. So if they want to practice their own religion in private, that's their business. But it must not come out in public, right?
Well, take for example in Florida, they have the satanic cult.
Yes.
In the Supreme Court.
Yes.
The Catholic state in position there,
You couldn't even tolerate that in private, could you?
We've answered that one already. If Satanism is wicked and foul even in private, then it ought to be stopped by the state, even in private, yes. There are degrees and grades and kinds of Satanism, but in itself, yes. The worship of the devil is so grave and so dangerous that it ought to be stopped even in private. St. Louis forbade blasphemy. St. Louis very severely punished blasphemy. And that, even blasphemy in private, he would punish severely, once it was known. Because it does such harm to the state, was St. Louis's idea. Therefore, man was not allowed to blaspheme. I think that he would punish blasphemy even in private, once it was known. Just like a sane state punishes homosexuality even in private, because it's so grave. It is so damaging to the fabric of society. Homosexuality is so antisocial that a sane society will clobber it even in private. And therefore, sane societies make laws against homosexuality even in private. That's how the United States was 50 years ago, and England and all the countries.
But we're still starting from the United States.
Yeah.
States are starting still there in place. They're kind of not being enforced against all the other
countries. So there's an example of the state wisely intervening in private. It doesn't wisely intervene on everything in private, but certainly on something so damaging as homosexuality.
Would you consider, for example, abortion as a heresy?
Abortion is not a heresy. Abortion is a grave crime. It's a crime.
Well, with that in mind, are we tolerating that? The government is not speaking out against it.
Yes, the modern government, starting with England in 1967, or maybe they were following Sweden, but England was one of the first, modern governments tolerate abortion, yes. And that is a grave disorder. It's a grave sin on the part of the state to tolerate abortion. Because again, abortion, like homosexuality, is such a grave crime against society. The whole future of society is on the line.
And what about homosexuality?
Similar.
You know, how do we justify Clinton's actually pushing homosexuality?
There's no justification whatsoever. There's no justification whatsoever. It's a very grave sin against the natural law and against God.
Well, you were saying here that, you know, we can tolerate this sin in public for the common good. That certainly is not for the common good.
I mean, this is not
common
intellectual,
but this is not for the even the military, before we left town, I heard the military speaking out against this.
Yes, yeah, well,
they don't want any part of it.
Well, thank you. We're not a
Catholic state, though.
Yeah.
I know we're not.
The United
States is not a Catholic state.
Yeah. Let's move on. On the other hand, liberals. We've got the liberal doctrine in six propositions, of which you've only got one sentence here, which obviously is much too brief. But liberals teach that human reason is the highest authority. We're back to rationalism. And so church and state must be separated. Because if human reason is the highest authority, then the state of human reason has no business having the church over it telling it what to do. Therefore the two must be separated. And so therefore liberals teach, in accordance with the supremacy of human reason, the separation of church and state. Okay? Then we've got a champion of liberalism, who was Father Murray. Thus Father Murray taught that all men have a natural right to practice in public their own religion. That is liberalism. That's not Catholicism. He taught that all men have a natural right to practice in public their own religion. The church teaches they have they may be tolerated. They don't even have a right to practice in private a false religion. They don't even have in private a right to practice a false religion, but they do. They may be tolerated. They don't even have a right to be tolerated. They may be tolerated, but they don't even have a right to be tolerated practicing a false religion in public. But it may easily be the wiser thing for the state not to pursue them if they practice a false religion in private. But what they may not do is practice it in public. And the state has an absolute right to repress the practice of non-Catholic religion in public unless the repression is going to be a greater evil than the toleration of it.
Bishop, being in France, when France is Catholic,
yes.
Roughly speaking, what is the range?
Well, it varies according to time, it varies according to place. For instance, at the time of the Reformation, the Huguenots were quite strong in France. And the Catholic government had to work out what it could do.
With the passage of time, finally in 1685, the Edict of Nantes, which tolerated the Protestants, was revoked. Some people say that was an error, some people say it was wise. But in any case, the state certainly had the right to revoke the Edict of Nantes. Whether it was wise to do so is a different question, but it had the right. If the Protestants are too many, going after them will do more harm than good, and therefore you leave them alone. But the more evil a state has to tolerate, not the more perfect that state is, but the less perfect that state is. Toleration is not something to be admired. Right? In this, number 11, Father Murray was wanting to conform Catholic doctrine to the outlook of contemporary man. He was another of these that wanted to fit the Church to the world. Or to the outlook of the United States Constitution. Father Courtney Murray, in point of fact, was an American. In point of fact, he was a great admirer of the Constitution. And he, like other American Catholics at the time of the Council, thought that America, by her practice of religious liberty, had something to give and something to teach to the Catholic Church. That's what he thought. That's what he believed, and that's what he acted on. Now, Monsignor Fenton, as an American, would absolutely not agree with that. Monsignor Fenton took the position, the Catholic Church has something to teach to the United States of America, as it has something to teach to all of us in all ages and in all times. No country has ever got anything to teach the Catholic Church. That would have been Monsignor Fenton's position. But Father Murray was a modern, and therefore he said, we in the United States have got something to give the Church. He didn't say he wanted to teach the Church, he's got something to give the Church. Right. The clash. Vatican II. This is four chapters on what happened. And it divides into the 4 years of the Council, 62, 63, 64, 65. First, the tradition rejected. And this was the Europeans. The Rhine flowed into the Tiber. And it was only after the Rhine had flowed into the Tiber that the Potomac flowed into the Tiber. But the Rhine flowing into the Tiber was the real problem. I think Father Kelly is now saying, arguing that, and I would absolutely agree. He was saying, he's saying that I'm quoting Michael Davis to the effect that, the Americans were responsible for everything that went wrong at Vatican II. I'm certainly not saying that. I don't think Michael Davis says that. The real fault was with the Europeans who wanted to go the wrong way. And then it was the Americans like Father Courtney Murray who taught them how to go the wrong way. The experts in religious liberty, supposedly, who said, well, if you want to go the wrong way, this is how to do it. So this is a story of Vatican II.
Cardinal brings to us the law.
Various Europeans.
He was the one up there. I mean, I know both books.
Lienard, Frings, there were a number of them.
Yeah.
Dirkner, yes. Also the one in Vienna was terrible. Right. There was a bunch of them. At Vatican II, firstly, the traditional schema or ground plan on religious toleration was thrown out. That's the one that Archbishop Lefebvre helped to prepare.
Yeah.
Then the Secretariat for Christian Unity took over. See, the traditionalists didn't speak about religious freedom. The traditionalists spoke about religious toleration, and already there's a world of difference between religious toleration and religious freedom. If you say religious toleration, you're suggesting that it's an evil that has to be tolerated, false religions. If you say religious freedom, you're suggesting that the false religions are a good thing. Completely different perspective. So, before the council, by Ottaviani and Monsignor Lefebvre, a schema was prepared of religious toleration. Within a few days, went into the circular file with all of these documents that the preparatory commissioner had prepared. And then the Secretariat for Christian Unity took over, and that was headed up by Cardinal Beyer. As Ottaviani said, Cardinal Ottaviani said, Beyer culpa, Beyer culpa, Beyer maxima culpa. Secondly, after 62, in 1963, the Americans began to move in because the Europeans had made the opening for them. No question. Within the Secretariat and on the Council floor, the American bishops backed Father Murray's alternate liberal text about religious freedom. 64, a bitter fight. The Declaration of Religious Liberty became a separate schema. It was pulled out of the decree on the Church, or whatever it was, and it was bitterly fought over in three drafts. There was no document that was more bitterly fought over. Finally, at 65, three more drafts were fought over, but the sixth and final text was approved by the Council, it was approved by the Pope, and it was approved by Father Murray. And Father Murray had an immense influence in drawing up the text on religious liberty, which is a masterpiece of confusing all of this. It's a masterpiece of confusion, the text on religious liberty.
It was that Bishop from Belgium who gave that big speech.
That's great, Monsignor de Smet. That's Appendix 4. And he gives the text. And it was a Belgian, as you say, that did a lot of the damage. Then, the Declaration on Religious Liberty. And here you've got the bones, just the bones of the thing. The problem of doctrine. That final text, the sixth text on the Declaration, the Declaration goes under the title of Dignitatis Humani, of human dignity. Right? And that's the perspective, remember, of the people that love liberty. Human dignity, human grandeur, human liberty. We are free, we are great, we are men. Men are great. Right? That's the perspective, that's the starting point of the liberty people. The starting point of the truth people is God. God is the way, the truth, and the life. He's instituted one religion, there's only one truth. If you start from the one, tradition starts out from God, and religious liberty starts out from man. That's the basic difference. And if you start out from man, you want to protect the grandeur of man, which is his liberty. Therefore, you want to protect his liberty. Therefore, you insist that he's going to have freedom for what religion he likes. And therein consists in his grandeur. If he breaks his faith by choosing the wrong religion, that's his problem, but he must have the liberty which is in fitting to his grandeur as a man. And it's always the grandeur of man which is your starting point. Tradition starts out from the grandeur of God, the greatness of God. God has created us, we are from God, we go back to God by a religion in which God died upon the cross. That is the way, the truth, and the life. And I must submit to it if I want to save my soul. That's a completely different perspective. The final text must be compared with Catholic doctrine. So DH is the Declaration of Religious Liberty. Because the last minute traditional addition to Article 1 left the untraditional parts of Dignitatis Humani unchanged. What happened was, when the sixth draft was presented to the council, a large block of Spanish bishops refused to vote it, or said they were not going to vote it, because it was so anti-traditional. At that point, since the document is a masterpiece of confusion and ambiguity, at that point, Pope Paul VI came in and added a traditional clause to the first paragraph, saying something like, nothing in this document contradicts tradition. But when he put that in, no change was made in the rest of the document. Therefore, the document was just as anti-traditional as it was before, only the Pope said that it was traditional. The Spanish bishops bought it, and they voted for the declaration, and through it went. The Pope overcame a considerable last-ditch resistance when he threw in that extra sentence. But the extra sentence didn't change one word of the rest of the text. So, that sentence in Article 1 doesn't solve the problem. There is a problem. 19. Dignitatis Humani, in effect, reduces Catholicism from being the one true religion to being merely one religion amongst many. That's what, in effect, it does. True, the document does allow the state to help religion by the state protecting public order in a broad sense. So the state may intervene to protect public order, but I mean, you could intervene to protect public order by protecting Protestantism, by protecting Mohammedanism. That's not necessarily protecting Catholicism. You're just protecting public order. That's not the same thing as the common good, as Michael Davis points out. The public order and the common good is more than just public order. Public order simply means you've got tranquility in the streets for everybody to go comfortably down to hell. The common good is that you're going to block, if you can, people going to hell. So the common good is a lot more than just public order. It's true that Dignitatis Humani does allow the state to intervene in religion for public order, but, 21, Catholics from far left to far right have alike recognized the problem in reconciling the Declaration of Religious Liberty with tradition. The two won't fit together. And the burning point is, chapter 22, the key point on which they clash is that the Declaration affirms and tradition denies that those who propagate error in public have a right to be tolerated by the state. That is the key point for that. And when the Catholic Church comes to its senses, it's going to have to clear up that point.
and it's going to have to either trash Dignitatis Humanae, or it's going to have to say this is the only possible way in which it can be interpreted. But the document is much better be trashed, just like the 1/8 poison cake. And it's more than Dignitatis Humanae is more than 1/8 poison.
By tolerate, they mean really protect and encourage, as opposed to tolerate in the sense that we were talking about earlier, where a Catholic state has the right to tolerate error. And here they have the right to be tolerated by the state.
I don't think there's a distinction on degrees of toleration. No, the propagators of error have a right for the state to leave them alone. They have a right to be left alone by the state. The state does not have a right to stop them if they're propagating error in public. Nor can such a right be based on the human person's dignity. This is a key point, because error takes away dignity. You see, on the liberty idea, my dignity is shown by my being able to follow error or truth regardless. On a Catholic basis, human dignity is only assured by following the truth. If I wallow in pornography, for instance, or if I start raving and grinning, I lose my dignity. I don't have dignity. I destroy my dignity when I wallow in sin. But for the liberty people, I am not destroying my dignity when I wallow in sin. I am demonstrating my dignity of freedom of choice. Two quite different perspectives. Where is the real dignity? The Catholic says dignity consists in loading the soul with merit. That's where dignity, in doing what's right and gaining merit, that's the dignity of a human being. The liberal says that Lenin, when he was shaking his fist at God and twisting half of mankind into a concentration camp, Lenin was practicing human dignity, because he was demonstrating the power of man to stand up to God, use his freedom even to stand up to God. You've got two quite different ideas of dignity. The liberal idea of dignity, any use of my free will demonstrates my dignity. Catholic idea of dignity, only moral liberty is dignity. License is indignity. What about the Californian dressed just in a pair of shorts with his elbow over the side of a car on a 5-lane highway, drinking a pop of can, a can of pop, with the radio blaring, is that dignity? With the radio blaring rock music?
He hasn't grown up with his
dignity. What would the liberal say about his dignity? The liberal would say that is exactly dignity. He is free. See? And it's an interesting that you point out the lack of maturity. Lack of maturity goes absolutely together with the refusal of any law. I can do as I like. Those people never grow up. They're like spoiled children. They never grow up. That's a common sense way of looking. It's a Catholic way of looking. Dignity goes with doing what's right. Or dignity goes with doing my thing. Two quite different ideas of dignity. So, 24, Father Murray died in 1967, leaving to the Church a legacy of liberalizing and Americanizing ideas. You'll have to excuse the Americanizing, but he was an American and he did believe in the Constitution, and that was an important part of his ideas. But please, there are Americanists in countries all over the world. I mean, the problem is liberalism, not the United States. The problem is liberalism, and that's international. For instance, and it's interesting, in 24, shortly before he died, Murray was for artificial means of birth control. Davis quotes and that shows you which way he was going. That shows you how Catholic his ideas were. He was for artificial means of birth control. Davis finishes, the last chapter is an example of how the liturgy was changed to fit Dignitatis Humanae. Anything about our Lord Jesus Christ being king, our Lord Jesus Christ having rights, the state having to submit to our Lord Jesus Christ, especially the feast of Christ the King. Out. That's out. That, they took a pair of scissors and all that was cut out.
What about the end of the year?
Guys. So, and you can go through, you can see what they did to the, for instance, the hymns of Christ the King. They were just cut to pieces. And that was Europeans that did that. It was Europeans that did that. Not Americans. Fornini was Italian. All right. It
interesting appendices. We've had this one before. The teaching of Vatican II, none of it had extraordinary fallibility because the popes always hung back from using their extraordinary fallibility. And only what was traditional had ordinary fallibility. And the doctrine of religious liberty is not traditional. Therefore, it had no kind of infallibility. No one has to believe religious liberty simply because Vatican II said so. A close examination in two of Pius IX's Quanta Cura and the syllabus on the one hand and Dignitatis Humani on the other. And Michael Davis says that between the authoritative teaching of Pius IX on the one side and Dignitatis Humani on the other side, there may not be direct contradiction, but that at the very least there's irreconcilability. In fact, I think there is direct contradiction. Archbishop Lefebvre says there's direct contradiction. Michael Davis is sort of, I think he's a bit hair-splitting there. That's the one point where you might argue with his book. Plenty of people say there's a direct contradiction. Because the church has always said, like in 22, there's direct contradiction. In many formerly Catholic countries, notably in Spain, the Declaration of Religious Liberty opened the way to a grave undermining of Catholic faith and morals. And that's the Spaniards' fault. It's got nothing to do with the United States of America. It's the Spaniards' fault. Spain is now in dead trouble. And it's going to be in more trouble than the United States. The liberalism in Spain is going to be worse than liberalism in the United States. Because when the best go bad, they go bad with a vengeance. And Spain was a very Catholic country, and so when Spain is going to be, it's going to be real trouble. The official spokesman of the council of Dignitatis Humani was a Belgian, Monsignor de Smet. And there's his speech in which he tries to show that the new doctrine is just a development of tradition. They say that his speech was written by Courtney Murray, but it was a Belgian who gave the speech. Five, you've got there the traditional doctrine written by Cardinal Taviani on how a state may tolerate public heresy. And that's laid out in the preparatory schema which Vatican II rejected back in paragraph 13. So there you've got some of the traditional schema. Six, you've got a famous speech of Pius XII in which he taught that states today, in today's corrupt circumstances, they may have to let go of their right to repress heresy. They may have to say, we can't repress heresy. But whether or not they choose that it's wiser not to repress heresy, in any case they have the right to do it. But it may be more prudent not to do it. It may well be more prudent not to do it. But the question of what's prudent in practice and what's right in principle are two different questions. And the two mustn't be blurred. It's not wrong in principle simply because it's wrong in practice. It may well be wrong in practice today, in all kinds of situations today, but that doesn't mean it's wrong in principle. But that's a famous speech in which, again, Pius XII has it absolutely clearly laid out. He thought very clearly, Pius XII. And finally, a chronological list from 60 to 65 of the events whereby this document emerged at the council. Tomorrow morning, Mass, there's Lord's at 7, and then there's a first Mass at 7:30, breakfast after that, and then, you know, your time is your own. There's another Mass at 10 o'clock, but I think that's it. Those of you that haven't yet written a sheet, please do, for the benefit of other people who might well come on the basis of what you write. And I'm not fishing for praise, believe me, but other people are needing encouragement. So, well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.